word had gone. This story was verboten. It was covered the same way the story would have been covered in the Soviet Union in 1955. It was just simply covered like it wasn't a story. You saw the low-hanging fruit, but that's just not something you talk about. Now, why is that? Why is the coverage so dreadfully bad? Part of it was due to the nature of the way professional journalism has devolved in the United States in the last 50 years, so that it basically accurately reports debates between people in power. So it accurately reflects the debates the heads of the Democratic and Republican Party are having. The problem with that wonderful theory of journalism is that if both of them agree on something, like having a secretive spying state and they aren't debating it, there's nothing for journalists to cover. And if a journalist raises the issue, they're considered ideological and unprofessional for talking about something people in power aren't talking about or debating. And that is a wonderful disciplinary effect in keeping journalists in line, not to want to be seen as ideological, unprofessional by covering a story people in power don't consider a legitimate issue. And the second factor, of course, which is unavoidable, that underscores that, is the institutional force, the corporate power that's involved there. That the institutions that dominate and own our news media ultimately are people who are very comfortable with the status quo in America, including the military-industrial complex, and they don't send out the vibes that they really want to challenge this. So ironically, or tragically, but certainly revealingly, it took a nonprofit newspaper from Britain, The Guardian, which is run by family trusts, so they aren't out to satisfy shareholders, they're not owned by billionaires. In Britain, another country that doesn't rely, get its cues from the American upper class on what a legitimate story is, to break this low-hanging fruit story. That says everything one needs to know.
And from the recent Democracy in Crisis conference convened in Chicago by Peace Action, Robert McChesney, and also speaking at that event, John Nichols and Bob Jensen, and of course Heidi Bogosian, New York's own head of the National Lawyers Guild. This is Earthwatch on WBAI in New York, Pacifica Radio Network, broadcasting at 99.5 megahertz FM, and streaming at stream.wbai.org. And you have been a fine audience tonight, and a significant one at this time of day, and we really appreciate that. And even more, your comments, thoughts, suggestions, queries, leaks, with an email to rknight, that's R-K-N-I-G-H-T, rknight at wbai.org. And we'll be back next week, Wednesday, midnight. And thank you for listening. Stay tuned for Hour of the Wolf coming up next with Jim Freund.
The Nation magazine as its Washington correspondent. He's the associate editor of the Capital Times in Madison.
Keep resisting.
There are few honors greater than to be on a panel with someone associated with the National Lawyers Guild. Because the National Lawyers Guild understands something fundamental about our rights and our freedoms.
Galaxy 3, Facebook and your search history, Gmail, voicemail, I gotta have it, it's got an on-off switch, baby,
I'm making a list. I'm checking it twice. It doesn't matter the message or even kind of device. Every pic your daughter sends, we've got it ingrained. Why do you think Anthony Weiner wants back in the game? Surveilling reporters, don't ever forget it. I got so many AP docs, you think I'm getting college credit? Yeah, we're saving your searches. That's just a reality. Yes, we can, ain't just a slogan. It's our view on legality.
Nokia, iPhone, Galaxy 3, Facebook, and your search history. Mail, voicemail, I gotta have it. It's got an on-off switch, baby.
I'll tell you this, sir. I greatly abhor your violating of the Constitution upon which you swore. And a full investigation is what's needed and more. If you ever Googled Justin Bieber pics, I yield back the floor. I don't see the big deal. Why are we having a cow? I mean, look at all the terrorists that we can focus on now. And it's not like we're planting devices in homes. By the way, did everybody get their free Obama phone?
Come on.
With front-facing cameras, our intel has grown. Look at the video we've collected from this year alone. This is outrageous. We should be able to use the bathroom freely. Hello? Hi. How'd you get this number, really? Nothing is private anyway.
We're posting on walls, so what's the big deal if the government is saving your calls? I mean, we share our info with companies. This debate should be chilled.
Everybody come quick! A straw man has been killed!
So the next time you're up late and you're surfing your phone, let me reassure you, baby, that you're never alone. And if you don't think that the spying stuff is really ideal, text yourself about it. Let us know how you feel.
Nokia, iPhone, Galaxy 3, Facebook, and your search history. Gmail, voicemail, I gotta have it. It's got an on-off switch, baby. I'll tap it.
Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a Wednesday night, Thursday morning program dedicated to science fiction, enchantment, fantasy, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. This morning, an interview conducted yesterday afternoon, that's Tuesday afternoon, with the great Kim Stanley Robinson. Stay tuned. Once again, good morning. Okay, as always, technical difficulties starting out, having to do this time, I won't even get into it. It's called Copyright Confessor, and it's a whole long, sordid story of things that we need to keep up with in order to, keep us alive with different grants. And the way things are going, every single penny counts. Okay, so we have an interview for you this morning. It is a great one. The sound quality is another question. I am still experimenting with creating sound at home using Skype. And actually, at this point, I have everything set at my end. But I have not yet figured out how to count on some other people. And they're having Skype set up. And we had Skype set up perfectly, Stan Robinson and I, but he didn't have a good microphone. So you'll forgive some of the sound quality, and there's also some scrabbling noise at a certain point. And in my end, at one point there's a car and a kid, and on his end, there's a cat. Well, it's all part of fascinating talk. And Stan Robinson is one of the great writers. I'm not even going to tell you that much about him because over the course of this interview, which runs about an hour, 20 minutes, so we better get cracking on it. We pretty much cover much of his career. But first, this coming Tuesday at the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings, October 1st. Now, of course, we hope to see you at the Atlantic Antic on September 29th, but 2 days later, on Tuesday, October 1st, at the Soho Gallery for Digital Art, which is at 138 Sullivan Street, between Houston and Prince, I will be holding the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings, and our readers are Kate Locke, who I've not yet met, but whose work I've been following, and she's really something. Terrence Taylor, who regular listeners to WBAI have heard any number of times, and our host will be Margot Adler. Yes, she who created Hour of the Wolf, and also she who has read, at this point, upwards of, I think we're up to about 290 vampire novels. And no, it's not just a fetish or an obsession. It is a study. Margot has a new book out about this called Out for Blood. It's what they call an Amazon single, but there's going to be a fix-up version, a larger version with all these notes she's taken on every one of those books coming out in about January. And assuming WBAI is still around in January, well, she'll be here to tell you about it. So, doors open at 6:30. The event begins at 7. Show up at 6:30 to be sure to get a good seat, and also because that's a good time to rub elbows, and we serve free cider and cheese and stuff like that. Admission is free. We do hustle for donations because I put a lot of money into making that event happen, and because we buy all of our participants dinner and drinks, to which, by the way, you are invited to come along. So, that's our Vampiric Lore special, our October special at the New York Review of Science Fiction. Again, 138 Sullivan Street. For more information, visit OurWolf.com, HOURWOLF, like the name of the show, Hour of the Wolf, or on Facebook. Look for NYRSF, NYRSF, New York Review of Science Fiction Readings, or just type in those words, or just type in my name, Jim Freund, F-R-E-U-N-D, and you will get all the information that you need. Okay, and then some. So, that should cover it. As I say, this is a long interview with a favorite writer. This is actually, his name is Kim Stanley Robinson, but this is his third time on the show. But you know what? He and I will go into that. I believe there is a moment in the middle of the interview where I probably should have made an edit, but failed to. It was just a question of, you know, some noise that was going out there that I should have cut out. Don't let it bother you. So we're going to start right now. And know also that Stan and I have arranged for another program in mid-November. And that will be live with phone calls. So look forward to that. So set your Wayback Machine to Tuesday afternoon for New York time and 1 p.m. where Stan was. And here we are.
This is Jim Freund. I'm speaking with Kim Stanley Robinson on the afternoon of the 24th, 3 hours difference, because you're in California and I'm here in New York. And this is, I think, you probably don't remember, this is actually our third interview. One time being a very long time ago. I can't even begin. I'm not even sure of the decade. I just know it was in New York. It was at a Nebula event, and Dave Hartwell introduced us at a party, and we went off for about 10 minutes.
I remember that. I think that was 1991.
That could be. Mm-hmm. And then after that, when you were guest of honor at Capclave, we ran into each other two nights, actually, with a whole bunch of the Capclave people, the night before the convention was going to begin. And there was a great Mets versus St. Louis Cardinals game that a whole bunch of us watched together. With a great...
If I was the guest at Capclave, that might have been 2006.
Wow, that long ago. Okay. Yeah, well, we can always figure that out by whenever the Mets were playing the Cardinals in the playoffs. And then you and I actually recorded an interview with people sitting around. It was actually a program item. And it was a lot of fun. And I think that the first book in which trilogy was it had just come out. Science in the Capital.
Yes.
Yes.
And I was at a Disclave, not as a guest of honor, as the first book had come out in 2004. So it might have been then.
Yeah, I don't think it was 9 years ago. I certainly hope it wasn't, because that really gives proof to the idea that as you age, and you and I are under a year apart, that time moves that much faster.
But that's true. Yeah. Time is flying.
I really don't like that. I object. But at any rate, a couple of congratulations. One on 2312 doing so magnificently and winning.
Thank you.
The Hugo just a few scant weeks ago, and deservedly so.
Well, to correct you, actually, although it did win the Nebula, it did not win the Hugo a few weeks ago.
Oh, okay. It was the
Nebula. I wish it had.
Right. Right. Well, it shoulda.
Yes.
And it did win the Nebula, which is gratifying. And you have a new book out, which it was actually Orbit Books that sort of brought us together this time. And
yeah, I am now published by Orbit Books. They're just a wonderful publisher. I'm really enjoying the relationship a lot. I think they I owe a large part of the success of these last two books to them.
Oh, okay. That's nice to hear, because I like them as well, and I like their publicist, Dylan Wright,
yes,
who brokered the meeting. That's the word I was looking for before. And this new book, Shaman, is it Shaman or Shaman?
I say Shaman.
Okay, good.
I hear both, I must say.
Yeah, I usually say Shaman. But again, I've heard both, so I'm never quite sure which is which.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a pretty much a brand new release. The official pub date was September 3rd.
Yes.
But before we talk about that, let's just give a little history, because this being bona fide radio as opposed to internet radio, although I'll branch out into that as well, there may be somebody who don't know your work, because Marvel Comics hasn't adapted it into a movie yet. So the thing that absolutely blew me away, that I think everybody in the world listening to this broadcast, aside from Shaman, must read, is the Mars Trilogy.
That's certainly what I'm best known for, and I think will always be my most popular work, partly because Mars is so popular, partly because it's a 2,000-page novel, a trilogy, and in a kind of form that people seem to like.
Yeah.
So, yes, the Mars trilogy. Still doing well after all these years. It's actually been 22 years since Red Mars came out.
And my God.
Maybe 15 years since Blue Mars came out.
Wow.
But it seemed to be wearing well. I mean, aside from the occasional reference to videotape and the like, they seem to be still reading in a somewhat contemporary way for new audiences, which is, of course, really a pleasure, because sometimes that doesn't work with science fiction.
Yeah, well, that actually brings up a question right there, because I know that by the time Blue Mars came out, there were things that were mentioned in Red Mars that where the science had learned a little bit more. I think like something about the permafrost had changed, that we knew more, and what was written in the first book was no longer exactly the same.
Well, some few things like that occurred, maybe, but I have to say I wrote the books at a very lucky moment, because what we knew about Mars then and what we know about it now, are there's nothing that we've learned since I wrote the books that that invalidates the trilogy or makes it turn into some kind of fantasy. There has been a lot of speculation about life still alive on Mars, bacterial life deep underground. Well, it's speculative, and just last week, the rover that's working there now discovered a lack of methane signals, and methane would have been a sign of certain kinds of bacterial life outgassing, but it's not there. So it's still up in the air, but it's seeming more and more likely that Mars probably is a dead planet, which is what the Mars trilogy postulated.
Yes.
So aside from that, the amount of water, the constituency of the atmosphere, the chemical nature of the rocks, the ability to terraform it, the topography, it all is exactly the way I had it in the trilogy.
And I thought the most important science in that trilogy was the political science.
Yes. Well, I also got lucky because I included Islamic cultures in a big way in my Martian future. Well, you have to remember that in the early 90s, this wasn't the obvious move. But ever since 2001, we've been much more aware that this global culture of ours has got some really serious cultural differences that are not automatically reconcilable and may go on for, you know, centuries to come without a grand reconciliation. And so the books read as if they are aware of what's happened in this last decade or so. And so that's probably true, what you say, in terms of predicting futures in the way that science fiction is supposed to. I think the books are good on the political and element.
Yeah. And just, you know, the sheer entertainment element, the opening set piece going right through, you know, without giving away any reveals, to what happens to our focused character for the first, 50, 70 pages or so alone. That will grab anybody.
Well, thank you. Yeah, that is the old technique of Homer, the in media res, beginning in the middle of the story. It is a very dramatic moment, and then you have to unpack what happened, because the story drops back a few decades to lead you up to that moment.
Yeah.
And what I think is interesting about the structure of Red Mars in particular is that the reader begins to become comfortable and think that they're going to be reading the whole novel in a state of knowing what's coming, because they're thinking that the whole novel will be backdrop up to the climactic moment of the first chapter. But in fact, at the end of chapter 5, you are suddenly cast past that moment into an unknown story space. And there's many a reader that has reported to me that they've had to read chapters 6 through 8 in a continuous burst of reading in order to find out what happens next, because they're shocked to be put back in that normal state of narrative uncertainty. So I think it's a good structure. I think it really casts people through the book, even though it's quite a fat one.
Yeah, it does. It remains one of my favorites. If anybody ever backed me into a corner on, you know, what's the best science fiction to read, and they're specifically looking for plausible science fiction. I won't say hard, but plausible science fiction. Or hard science fiction. That would be in one of the top books I would name.
Yeah, well, thanks. And I like this word plausible as opposed to hard science fiction. I don't like the name hard science fiction. I think it's a subcategory that doesn't actually exist, and it's not something I'm interested in.
Yeah, exactly, because I think it sort of went out of date after Hugo Gernsback.
Well, I actually think the Mars trilogy itself somewhat collapsed the concept of hard science fiction, because hard science fiction before the Mars trilogy was always hard politically in that it was kind of right-wing stuff, and the Mars trilogy is left-wing, and so therefore the idea that hard science fiction could be typed politically fell apart, and after that the whole concept began to look really squishy.
Well,
which is ironic given the name.
Yeah. Well, exactly. But that brings up a whole other question right there about the presence or lack thereof sometimes of progressive politics in science fiction up until a certain point. And I think that you were one of the vanguards, maybe you and Theodore Sturgeon.
Well, that's... Theodore Sturgeon puts it back quite a long ways.
Well, that's why I mention him, because I think he was one of the first.
Mac Reynolds and Ursula Le Guin, a whole crowd with feminist science fiction and really 60s, the New Wave. The New Wave is, in general, quite progressive. So, no, I think there's a long-term tradition that it even includes H.G. Wells and Olaf Stapledon that are relatively, or in any sense, progressive and leftist utopian science fiction.
Yeah, and Fred Pohl comes to mind as well.
Yes, very much so.
So I guess I have to eat those words.
And Asimov.
And Asimov. But the thing is also that those people were, for the most part, with the exception of Le Guin in books like The Dispossessed, they weren't necessarily writing about something in which politics was of such a great focus. Because when you take a look at the other, quote, hard science fiction, end quote, that existed before that, yes, they were... Jerry Pournelle, Robert Heinlein, I'm not quite sure how to categorize Larry Niven, L. Ron Hubbard, people who were at the very least militaristic, although it's hard to define Gordy Dixon, because he's very militaristic, but he's also rather progressive.
Well, yes. I think the most you can say is that science fiction is a really good instrument for discussing politics without being boring in terms of plots and action and narratives that have a political meaning attached to them that that can be unpacked or decoded and is part of the fun. And it's almost inevitable that if you're going to postulate future societies that you're going to have underlying it as part and parcel of it a sort of political theory of history or a philosophy of history. So this is one of the things that science fiction does. And of course, that being the case, you get the complete spread from the far right to the far left and everything in between.
Yeah. And I guess for some reason... I think of you when I think of that. Maybe it's just that my personal politics, which are progressive / radical, resonate when I read your work. And I sit there going, yes, this is what I want. This is what I agree with.
Well, thank you. I mean, it's good to be part of that community. It's one of the things I like doing. It's interesting as I go further on in my career, I'm trying to make sure that I am writing novels that can be enjoyed by anybody of any political persuasion. And if people are arguing with it, that's fine, because that's one of the things that science fiction's about, too. I would say that really the Mars books and on from there, they are more and more subtle in their approaches to politics. And maybe I should make an exception for the Science and the Capital trilogy, because being in Washington, D.C., it was hard to be very subtle. But for the rest of my books, and especially I would say in 2312, there is, I think, a wider appeal or a less obvious political agenda, let's put it that way.
As long as we don't define, and I don't define climate change as a political agenda, although there are those who would deny it, and
no, I'm not. No, climate change, I think, is a scientific prognosis of great robustness, and basically we're in it already. So it's the response to it that has been politicized, and pretty much during the time while I was writing those books, it became more than before a element of faith in the Republican Party that climate change had to be denied and efforts to mitigate it fought, because mitigating climate change is going to require collective public, i.e. government action. And so just as a matter of political philosophy, they didn't want to agree that the phenomenon existed, because if they agreed that the phenomenon existed, then government action is necessarily involved in the solutions to the problem. So, and also the polluting of the atmosphere is an economic cheat. It's not being paid for. It's like throwing trash in the streams back in the 50s and 60s. It was, for a while, it was okay to exteriorize your costs and throw your waste into the environment and wreck it for everybody else. Then the Clean Air Act, Clean Water Act, and suddenly it became not okay anymore to pollute with your wastes of your industrial processes. Well, now all businesses and really all of us are doing that without paying the costs, and so paying the costs is something that has to be imposed. It doesn't just come out of free market stimulus. And that is a problem, because there are some people who believe that the free market is the only rubric that needs to be applied to human affairs. And it's a fundamentalism, and all the fundamentalisms are deeply flawed and anti-humanist and crazy, I would say. and that's true of all the religious fundamentalisms, but also the economic fundamentalisms. And in this case, we've got to be aware that we've got to act on the climate, and that it transcends political beliefs. So, you know, even saying that becomes an intensely political statement, that if a novel says that, then you really have quite a political novel. And so that's just true of Science and the Capital, no matter how I tried to avoid it. And no matter how I tried to make it into a comedy, basically a domestic comedy of families living in America, you know, in this century.
Yeah, we should tell listeners, by the way, that they won't find a book called Science in the Capital. We're talking about 40 Signs of Rain, 50 Degrees Below. That's what just came out when we were at Capclave. So, yeah, that. And 60 Days and Counting are the three books.
Thank you for that. Yes. I always called them Science in the Capital, and it's true that this name appears nowhere except on the internet. It will lead you eventually to the titles. But it's best to think 40, 50, 60.
Yeah, that's one of the advantages, by the way, to doing an interview through Skype, is that I can be browsing and boning up on my memory by using the internet simultaneously. So
nice. Very nice.
Yeah, something I can't do as easily when live on the air, because I have to pay attention to engineering and the console and stuff. Skype has its own problems, but now I mean, you have such a body of work to talk about, and I'm not sure if we want to do the whole thing of naming each one, but we should let people know. What we're talking about it. And I even jumped from Mars to Science in the Capital. In between that was Antarctica, which is related to the Mars books. And then the years of rice and salt. Antarctica. Now tell people how that came about.
Well, I was doing the research for my Mars books, and Antarctica is the best analog we have on Earth. And in reading about Antarctica, I found out that the National Science Foundation sends artists and writers down there. And so immediately I applied, at first for my Mars books, and they said, no, we won't send you. We only send down people who are writing about Antarctica specifically. So I applied again, saying I wanted to write about Antarctica specifically, and they agreed and sent me down there in 1995. As it turns out, I mean, the book comes after the Mars trilogy. It's not connected to the Mars trilogy, really, even though it shares a lot of concerns and is both of them are cold places. But the characters in Antarctica are actually show up as minor characters in the Science in the Capital trilogy. So in a way, Antarctica serves as a kind of unnecessary prelude to the Science in the Capital trilogy. But it's a sort of it's a standalone novel about what it's like down there in Antarctica today, and I'm very pleased to report that it's still kind of the main narrative that people go to when they go to Antarctica. Then they read that novel in order to be brought up to speed and to understand the culture down there better, especially the locals that is to say the people who work down there for entire seasons. Then for them, my novel is sort of their story. And so it has a nice ongoing life down there.
Yeah, I remember when you were down there, and this is the very earliest days of the web, although I've been online since the early 80s on the internet, but there was no web. And there were people in Antarctica that were sending out messages through BBSs and stuff about classes in science fiction that you were teaching.
Well, I had a lower profile than that. I was a roving reporter. NSF gave me carte blanche to go where I wanted, and scientists would invite me out to their field stations, and I would helicopter out with extra coffee and be welcomed by scientists who would then let me watch what they do and also help them in ways that I could, very simple things like replacing batteries or screwing in screws. Or taking data down as people told it to me. I did work for them, very simple stuff. And then the thing that you may be referring to is that I did have a fairly famous and glorious lecture at McMurdo called Antarctica as Utopia. And I had an enthusiastic crowd of maybe 500 or 800 people, which was about a third of the population of McMurdo at the time. Crowd into the galley, and it was a pretty raucous session as people were amused or horrified to think of Antarctica as it's run right now as a kind of utopia. And so I think that's been remembered, although it was not, I was not professionally recorded, and I don't think it's on the internet. It's usually the case that the best of my talks don't actually make it to the internet. There's some kind of inverse correlation going on there.
Oh, we've got to fix that somehow. Because I'm trying to figure out also how to get my radio programs. They stream on the internet, but I have interviews with people going back 30, 40 years where I'd love people to hear my interview with, say, Clifford D. Simak or Frank Herbert or Joanna Russ, who I've met several interviews with, and so forth. And I want to make these available.
Yeah.
So.
Well, in my case, I have the feeling it's the one that got away phenomenon, in that because they aren't recorded, I have this feeling that they were good. And if I actually had a record of them, I would look and I'd realize they're just like all the rest, which is somewhat messed up.
Yeah. But actually, what I'm remembering is not so. This may have been derivative of the lecture, but what I remember was actually a reading list that you had put out.
Yes. Yep, I think at the lecture itself, I did indeed give people a reading list in science fiction, just so that they knew what to go for. I think that one of the things that the people in the science fiction community can do for the world at large is serve as a kind of native guide and make lists of important novels that pretty much everybody would agree are what you need to read to be aware of the tradition and to have a good time and to just read the best there is.
Yeah, and that's what I think I saw online. It could be that somebody down there typed it up and posted it somewhere in Usenet, more likely than the web.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised.
Yeah, and I picked up on that, and it was a great list. And maybe we should revisit that sometime. I'll send you an email with the list and ask you to update it being a few years later.
That would be fun. I've kept up. I mean, there's too much science fiction to be completely caught up for any person whatsoever. You know, even the professional reviewers or the people who read a book a day, there's more than you can keep up with. But I have kept up with what seems to me to be a tremendous body of work in this last. I mean, now even my Antarctic trip is getting close to being 20 years ago, which amazes me.
Yeah.
But I've run into so many good books in the last 20 years. It would be fun to update that list.
Yeah, well, let's talk about that when you get back. We haven't discussed at all the California books. The Orange County trilogy, I'm seeing, is how it's referred to as on Wikipedia. But that's The Wild Shore of the Gold Coast and Pacific Edge.
Yes, they're still in print from Tor Books, and they're called. There's a very handsome trade paperback edition of the three together with covers done by the same artist, and they call that trilogy Three Californias, which is a title I came up with long after writing the books, but I think is a great title for those three, because really they're not a trilogy. They don't make one story. They're three different visions of California's future. And I think they still get read, especially in California, as visions of what we could do in Southern California or what might happen. But, you know, now those books are from the 80s because I've been writing for a long time. And it's amazing to me that they hold up as well as they do. But it was a function of choosing three different futures so that the After the Fall is kind of a fantasia that always remains possible. The dystopia seems to be what we've enacted since the Reagan years, and the utopia is something that we're still working on. So I think they're still useful. They're more compact novels. They're written in what I would have to call an earlier style, but I think they hold up pretty well, and I think that Tor is about to release them as an ebook trio when they get done processing these books, that they will offer them as ebooks, and that should give them a new life, which I'm really happy.
Yeah, the thing that I love about ebooks is that it means there is no reason on Earth or Mars why any book should be out of print anymore.
Yeah. Well, they aren't really. As long as you can get that ebook version out, you've got a backlist, and people can just download them and have them. And so that's one of those developments that's been coming along, and I presume those books will get a little new lease of life when the ebooks become available. But I have to admit that, you know, these days it's certainly true that my focus has been on the books on the Mars trilogy since, especially Years of Rice and Salt, which continues, like the Mars books, to have a good good sales and an active audience response online. And then, of course, 2312 being the latest and Shaman being the new one. So those are the ones that I really am tending to focus on in both my own mind and in, you know, the interactions with audiences.
How about short stories?
Well,
Jonathan
Strawn edited a best of collection for Nightshade's book. So there's a best of Kim Stanley Robinson, which really just means best of my short stories. And Jonathan did a fantastic job of editing that. He made choices that I wouldn't have been able to make and put them in the right order. And so that, I think now you can get my short stories in a fairly solid collection. It has almost everything I would want people to read out of my short fiction, is what it comes down to.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I had to giggle because there was a car in my end and then I think a cat at yours. So,
well, I do have a cat, but I think it all was coming from your end. I heard a squeak like a young child maybe getting dodging a car or something like that.
Ah, no.
Okay.
But it could be. I don't know. But we're going house to house. We're not exactly radio studio here. Do you have, okay, this is always a tough question, yet it's a very easy one, but how to phrase it is the hard part for me. Is there any kind of a preference, or what is the difference between writing the short form versus the long form?
Well,
I was just going to comment that the short form can often take as much work, almost as much work as a novel. And, you know, for that, somebody might get $100 instead of, you know, a living.
Well, that's right. The business is mainly constructed around novels, which is fine by me because I feel like a novelist. I like working at the scale of the novel. I'm completely in love with the form. And I feel like every time I write a new novel, I'm solving new problems, and I've got some craft built up from the previous novels that allow me to take creative approaches to it. And in short, I'm a novelist, and I love novels. Now, I started by writing short stories, and I certainly enjoyed it while I was doing it. I haven't done it really for 10 years since I finished The Martians, which is a kind of companion set of stories to the Mars trilogy. So, and I do think that short stories are very, very hard. Not that they take as much time, because they definitely don't. But what they do take is an idea that is something that you really can encompass in a short story amount of pages. And those ideas are not easy to come up with. So I would say that I would love to do more short stories, but I not having that.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I ran away for a second to close a window because, yes, there was a child out there. And then I noticed that we started breaking up. So I'm going to put a mark here. And